For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the treasures behind Chamber of Secrets, Chapter 14, Cornelius Fudge, the worst.
The worst, the worst. Well, actually, I don't even know if in this chapter he is the worst, but I also don't think he deserves to have this chapter named after him.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's necessarily named after him. He's not like book five, the worst, in the way that he will eventually become, but there's like shades of it.
There's shades of it for sure. I mean, it's like there's probably like commentary to be made about the level of reaction the opening of the Chamber of Secrets inside of this chapter that I think is disproportionate based on everything else that has happened the rest of the year.
Yes.
It's very much like, it's kind of like, you know, there are people actively being attacked in the school. There is unknown like hate text being painted on the walls, presumably in blood. And basically the school is just sort of like, yeah,
well, it's happening. Like, yeah. But you know what? These things happen, right? You know, it's like you almost have to get the feeling that like petrification is like not like in the wizarding world. It's just sort of like someone got petrified. God, that's a bummer. But like, yeah, I mean, obviously we'll just sort of undo it.
Yeah, right.
Kind of
right,
thing. Like, yeah. Like it must not be registering. I guess people don't even know though that well, like they're sort of hushing it up. But the other thing is that apparently it's happened before. And it's like, this is the, yeah, you're right. It's like the timing of everything is what seems so weird because like, they're like, oh, it's been four attacks, got to be seen to be doing something. And it's like, why is four the number?
Right.
Like if you think it's the Chamber of Secrets and this exact pattern happened before and you are like 1,000% sure you caught the right person last time and that person still works at the school, like immediately you should have gotten Hagrid immediately.
That's the thing. Yes. Yeah. And so I think what I find interesting about this chapter, and we can talk about it now or talk about it then, but like, you know, the idea here is that the chapter is titled Cornelius Fudge because we're being introduced to the Minister for Magic for the first time, where he's showing up basically to prove to the wizarding populace that he is on top of the situation, that like action is happening. It's taking place, like not to worry. And it's like on that level, I do feel like from like a politician's standpoint, there is like the need in instances like this where it's like, you know, you need to show that there is progress, because otherwise people are going to be like, y'all, what are we doing about the problem? And it's like, oh, we're currently doing nothing. You know, so it's like in general, people want to see there being progress to be made. And it's like, the question is, are the attacks inside of this chapter just the first time that the greater wizarding populace is being made privy to the situation at all?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, it's really the phrasing of his sentence, got to be seen to be doing something.
Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah, like, you're right.
It's like,
yeah.
The only reason I'm doing it is so that I'll be perceived as handling the problem. He's not even like of the mindset, like we need to handle this problem, you know?
Right.
It's not like we've got to do something, because it's like you are doing something. You are doing exactly what you should be doing, presumably.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Like it's like, not like got to be seen to be. I'm only arresting Hagrid so that I will be seen as doing something. I'm not arresting Hagrid because I think he did it, which I still do think, which is the weird thing.
Well, that's the question. So it's like, in my mind, I almost have to imagine, because I know that going into Order of the Phoenix, it's like we'll learn more about like Fudge's relationship with Dumbledore and sort of like, I think maybe his possible, you know, imposter syndrome relative to Dumbledore's brilliance, where it seems like for most of his time in office, he's usually written to Dumbledore to get advice from Dumbledore,
yeah,
in terms of like, you know, how should we be going about things, and like, you know, while Dumbledore doesn't want to accept the position himself, you know, he's like happy to like consult in the comings and goings. And so inside of this chapter, to me, it definitely reads as though Fudge like does have a deep respect for Dumbledore, like,
yeah,
you know, even like when Lucius Malfoy shows up, it doesn't really come across to me like Fudge is on Lucius's side.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he definitely is sort of like, hold on. I'm doing this for some political points, but if you want to act like, I think we definitely should not be removing Dumbledore. We all agree on that, right?
Yeah. It seems like that's basically the spot that he's in. And so in my mind, I mean, again, assuming Fudge is always just mostly looking out more for himself than anything else, there's a piece of me that wonders like whether or not like he knows that by coming here under these circumstances and enacting the plan of the governors of the school, which, you know, this book is really the only book I think we ever, maybe in Prisoner, do we hear a little bit more about the governors? It doesn't matter. They make it seem like the governors are going to be like a big deal.
Yeah, like they're going to constantly be a thorn in your side.
Right. Like, or yeah, that we should know any of them at all other than Lucius Malfoy.
Right, yeah. Who are the other 11 governors?
Right, yeah. We never have any idea.
We don't know. Seems like they'd be coming to like the Quidditch matches and stuff, you know?
It definitely seems like, yeah, these are patrons of the school who are like, you know, like stepping into a board of directors position,
right,
probably due to their prominent roles in other aspects of wizarding society.
Or else because their own children are at the school.
Or that.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But so anyway, I think, you know, like the tight space that I'm imagining Fudge being caught between here is basically like being called to perform a particular action. Because to your credit, it's sort of, or to your point rather, it's like, why didn't they do this from the start? And in my mind, Fudge probably from the start, like, wasn't feeling enough pressure from the rest of the world and was like, I don't really want to like rock the boat in my relationship with Dumbledore. So like,
right,
I'm going to not do that, you know? And then it's sort of like, okay, well now my hand is forced and like the optics are getting really bad. So it's kind of like a Peter Pettigrew kind of situation.
I mean, I think it is Dumbledore who says it in, maybe it's in the fourth movie or something, or maybe it's in one of the books, but it's something along the lines of like Fudge is doing like what is easy, not what is right, sort of thing.
Sure.
And it's sort of like, that's sort of been the case the whole time, because it's like you're at like, what's easy is not rocking the boat with his relationship with Dumbledore despite students being attacked, and the suspect of the last occurrence of this 50 years ago still being present at the school.
Right.
You know, it's like Dumbledore couldn't help but notice. I got a report about students being petrified. This happened again.
Right.
50 years ago, happening now. Got to do something. Sorry about that. Like,
right,
that's the right thing to do immediately.
Right.
As opposed to the easy thing of just like, well, Dumbledore's got it. And if he says it's not a problem, it's not a problem.
Right.
Like, and it's like, this is such a weird thing to argue, because like, of course they're all wrong about Hagrid.
We know they're wrong,
but they don't know they're wrong, and they think they're right. And if they think they're right, and they aren't, I mean, again, this is all based on just Tom Riddle's word 50 years ago, but right, as far as they're concerned, they are right. They know it's Hagrid, and so that they're not acting on it is bananas.
I know, that's the thing. That's like what's so weird about it, though, is that it's almost like, it's like Fudge's inaction is almost more like his proper action is probably something that we, the readers, would be more upset with. Like, if they had come and hauled Hagrid off from the very beginning, we'd be like, no, what the heck? Like, that's even more time he unnecessarily had to spend in Azkaban. Like, it obviously wasn't him, but it's like, again, yeah, it's like, it's not obviously not Hagrid, and probably a lot of this stuff should have happened way sooner.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to be like arguing against Hagrid, against Dumbledore, in favor of like the ministry action.
Right.
Because we the readers know that the ministry tends to not necessarily.
We have all the information.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, but you're right. Yeah. So it's like, if you change your position inside of the story a little bit, it's sort of like maybe this is the correct course.
There's a lot of weird decisions in this chapter.
Yes.
Well, let's just touch on the chapter art real quick. I felt like this one was a little more meh then maybe some of the others. It's basically just the list that Lucius Malfoy brings to cart Dumbledore away, I think.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it looks more like it could be the chapter art for like Dumbledore's army.
Yeah, it does look more like that. Like at the top of the list is just the big, very like informally written Roman numeral 12.
Yeah.
Which I assume stands for the 12 governors.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
That stands to reason. Yeah. I think I can follow that logic. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's a very like Declaration of Independence looking long, lengthy, ancient scroll type thing. But yeah, I mean, really all of that, I mean, it's the name of the chapter, but really most of this happens sort of like at the very tail end.
Yeah. Just sort of right at the end there.
So anyway, I guess you want to dive in and we'll just kind of like work our way through it.
Yeah. We'll work our way through. I'm sure we'll bring up a lot of the same points as we go, but let's see. So we start out, and as a reminder, at the end of the last chapter, Harry flies back out of the diary and realizes that, oh my gosh, it was Hagrid who opened the Chamber of Secrets 50 years ago.
Yes.
And so now they're sort of like, they've always known Hagrid's had a liking for
large and monstrous creatures.
And then the first thing I highlighted here was just like, Harry was sure that Hagrid would have gone to any lengths to have glimpsed it if he thought there was a chamber, or if he thought there was a monster like lurking around the castle, which is an interesting like thought, because like it's actually not even true. Because like the last time the chamber was opened, like Hagrid wasn't looking for the monster.
Sure. Right. Yeah. So, and I think like this whole book really is all about sort of like, it's a big whodunit, I think, is like what's really kind of going on. And I think that this chapter takes that like yet to another level. But I mean, we've talked a lot about like Percy being an obvious red herring. There's sort of like the little mentions of Ginny being here, there, and everywhere. There's like all of like Draco's, you know, slurs and stuff like that, that sort of like puts him as like an obvious, you know, center target. There's Dobby at the very beginning, who is coming from someone somewhere, which,
right,
I mean, probably wouldn't be that hard to figure out that it could be the Malfoys, just if you're assuming it's going to be connected to someone we know.
I mean, they guess it pretty immediately.
Right. You know, and then like, so I don't know if like every good whodunit you've ever watched, the way that they usually unfold or read as you're going through the story is like, you basically think like, well, it can't be them. And then someone at some point will like build the case against them, and all of a sudden it starts to look really suspicious. And you're
right.
There kind of is. There kind of is something there. Like he did make that comment, and you know, and then so I think this chapter is basically like, you know, you would have left on the cliffhanger at last chapter being like, Hagrid, what? No, like the gentlest, kindest, friendliest, you know, just looking out for everybody, just working hard, living in his humble existence, mm-hmm, like Hagrid. It's like, how could it be? And I think that basically to answer that question, it's like, well, lest we forget that he does have a giant three-headed dog that's named Fluffy that was being used basically, you know, in a parameter where Dumbledore himself like declares, you know, do not go to the third floor corridor unless you wish to suffer a most painful death.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, so Fluffy, a bit dangerous.
Yeah.
Then, you know, he's trading valuable Hogwarts information for Norbert and the dragon egg.
Right.
You know, he's got Fang, who, I mean, for all intents and purposes, Fang seems pretty okay.
Right, yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I mean, he's always sort of like had an affinity for large creatures and such. So like, I suppose maybe like, even if what's happening with Hagrid, or even if what you're supposed to be believing about Hagrid as like a potential target, is something along the lines of like, well, maybe he wasn't malicious in his intent.
Right.
But maybe his curiosity got the best of him.
Right. And then it got out of control.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And that's like a grand example of like, okay, like there's intent versus impact. You know, it's like if you were to assess the two there, like if Hagrid was the one who had opened the Chamber of Secrets, his intention was not to rid the school of
Muggleborns. It's just to see the monster.
It's raw curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, so intentions are good, impact is bad.
Right.
Myrtle dies. On the flip side, then you've got someone like Tom Riddle who like wants to open the chamber to rid the school of
Muggleborns.
You know, his like, you know, his intentions are bad and the impact is bad.
Yes.
You know, so yes. I you know, it's yeah. I don't know. So I think basically it doesn't even seem, I mean, the chapter doesn't even get all the way through where you're suspecting Hagrid of being the potential villain. But I suppose there are a couple of other instances that maybe like could quietly still not exclude him as we go forward. Because one of the other big things that we have happening inside of this chapter is Harry's room is being like ransacked.
Yeah, yeah. That is the other big thing that's going to happen in a couple of pages.
Yes.
Here. Let's see. I guess we'll get to that.
Okay.
I guess the other issue with Hagrid is that, like, even if he did it 50 years ago and he didn't mean to do it, you can almost rule him out because it's like, but why would he have opened it again? You know, like, what would make him reopen it then?
Right.
You know?
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and that's, like, one of those where, you know, it's like, is it a slow game? You know, I mean, like, Snape is actively quietly keeping a foot in two camps for most of our saga and everything. It's like, right. Is there a world where it's like, okay, you know, I was going to do it to Harry on his first year, but then, you know, I mean, it's like any good villain, all you have to do is just give them the monologue and explain their story. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh man.
Oh, right. Like if Hagrid was like, I was going to befriend you or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I had won Dumbledore's trust and I knew I just had to bide my time.
Right.
I went very Leprechaun.
Yeah. You did a little bit there.
Yeah, That's my bad. I normally go pirate whenever I try to do Hagrid. But yeah, I mean, you could see that being like, you entered your first year and you know, you trusted me and I kept guiding you towards the danger.
Right.
You
know,
like, I mean, it's like, after all, when you look at like Sorcerer's Stone, Philosopher's Stone, like throughout the whole saga, like Hagrid is the one who keeps slipping information, you know,
yeah.
It's like he's got like a lot of, you know, blood on his hands. So
right.
Speak,
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Whatever.
Like, and then he, you know, he has them deal with Norbert instead of him doing it himself. And
right. Right.
Yeah.
And it is that. A beast. That's right. Castle.
Yeah. Anyway, so we get to the next page here. Hermione says Riddle might have got the wrong person, which is a very clever way to phrase this sentence, I think, because it makes you like you agree with Hermione. And it's even true that Riddle got the wrong person because, of course, Riddle is the one doing it.
Right.
But it's like that like throws like blame away from Riddle. It's like Riddle might have got the wrong person. It's like, yes, you want to believe Hermione, like that's true. He might have gotten the wrong person. It's like, but like because she phrases it like that, you don't think that it is Riddle.
I know.
You still
know.
Like it's just that he made a mistake, not that Riddle did it.
yes, exactly. And yeah. I think that does like sort of continue a little bit. She does have like one of those Ron moments from last week where it says maybe it was some other monster that was attacking people. And it's like, Yes, it was.
Yes, it was.
Dead ringer.
Dead ringer.
That is exactly correct.
Yeah, and then I love how Ron responds. Says, how many monsters do you think this place could hold? I'm like, well, so far, Fluffy, Norbert, two trolls, the giant squid, Aragog, so a bunch.
Technically, more than you would expect. It's a pretty big castle. It's
a
pretty big castle. Then we go back to sort of pointing the gun potentially at Percy again.
Yep.
Where Ron makes the comparison, like Riddle does sound like Percy. And this is kind of interesting to me because I think to your point about Hermione, where it's like she's saying something where it's like, okay, let's take the blame off of Hagrid. Riddle probably still a good guy. The other thing that's happening with Riddle that I think is interesting inside of all this is that like Harry keeps relating to Riddle.
To Riddle, yeah.
You know, so like he's this like dark-haired orphan boy who's kind of like sees Hogwarts as his home.
Yep.
He's been celebrated as like a little bit of a hero, you know, so it's like, you know, they're kind of one for one in a lot of different ways. But then the comparison of Riddle to Percy, it's sort of like, you know, okay, now we're thinking like Riddle's kind of like Percy, and Percy has also been someone who's been at the center of our investigation for most of the book.
Right.
If you're just going on your first pass and don't know anything else, you certainly would have to be suspecting Percy at least a little bit.
Right. But then the way this is, Riddle does sound like Percy. So then it's like, but if you think it's Percy, then does that mean you should think it's Riddle?
That's a good point.
Right, yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But then Ron's question is, Riddle does sound like Percy. You asked him to squeal on Hagrid anyway, like as if Ron's opinion is like, so a few people got attacked. Like, don't squeal at it. No one's dead. Right?
Right.
Like, as if you haven't been trying to figure out this exact mystery all year.
Right.
And then Hermione's, of course, like, but someone died, Ron.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, of course, they did this last chapter where they were like, oh, yeah, a girl died. When, like, Dippet's talking to Riddle and is like, a girl died. And it's like, why wouldn't you just say Myrtle died?
Yes.
You know, yeah, you're doing thing where you're vague on purpose. You could have said whose name it was.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Anyway.
No, the, I mean, the I feel like the book does the story at large so far seems to do this all the time, where there's the hilariously bad timing of anybody showing up every time Harry's in, like, a compromised situation. Yeah. I think in this book, there's going to actually, or in this chapter, there's an instance like where it's like, should we go and talk to an adult? And it's like, no, we should definitely not go and talk to an adult.
I mean, I think it's for, I highlighted, at least laid it on the page when Hermione's like, do you think we should go ask Hagrid about it all?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Please go do that.
Right.
It's like, and if you, in event, because of course, eventually they do, but if they'd done it then he could have told them everything.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No, you're dead right. And I mean, this is like, I think what must have been like the challenge in writing is just constantly needing to like create this maze for the characters to like walk through, to where it's like, should we do this? It's like, no, we ruled that out for good reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, 4 pages later, we should definitely go talk to Hagrid.
Do that. Oh, yeah. It's too late now. Oh yeah. Man.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, that's so often the case. It's like, I wonder how often you're doing this, like, in real life, too, where it's just like, well, I know I should do that, but it might, like, bother that person, so I just won't.
So I just won't.
It's like, yeah. If someone's reading your book, they're like, why? Just go talk to them.
No, I get you. I get you. I literally had this happen yesterday because I've been trying to keep seahorses for quite some time.
Yeah.
And I was communicating with the breeders of the seahorses. Okay. And I was like, yeah, I'm using this like super high quality like frozen shrimp food.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, no, that's way too big. You should be using a smaller version. And it's like one of these things where like one of the first things I ever learned was this particular shrimp I always use is like the best shrimp for the case.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the most nutritious that there is. And then it was like, yeah, but it's too big for seahorses. Horses, small little snoots. And I was like, I never even considered using a different food other than the food that's obviously the best food. So this just happened to me this week. And so as you were describing that, I was like, I have to give this example.
This is it. There
especially
it is.
Since it's seahorses, which are so quirky and weird.
Ben also manages an aquarium company.
Oh, yeah, for context. Yeah. It's like, why is like, Ben talking about seahorses? Yeah, there's the context. Aquarium company.
So there's that. Let's see. So there's it's been like four months. Is that what it says? Since the last attack, I think.
Yes, 4 months. Right? Yes, since Justin and Neely had the snake. Yeah.
Everyone seems, it's like all of a sudden everyone seems to be like, I guess it's fine. It's over. Who even cares anymore? Because like Ernie McMillan asked Harry quite politely to pass a bucket of leaping toadstools in Herbology one day. And just like this to me doesn't add up at all, because it's like, what, like even if Ernie has decided, you know what? Harry seems to have given it up. 4 months later, he hasn't done anything. What a laugh, am I right? As far as we know, he still thinks Harry did it, but I guess he's just like, well, if he quit, who even cares?
Who can stay mad after four months?
Who can stay mad? He petrified my friend. Whatever.
No, I think this is totally... I kind of agree with your early assessment that like maybe petrification is like in the wizarding world not as dire as we tend... like as we would interpret or read it as. It's like it's massively inconvenient. But on the other note, it is the second year Herbology class that raises mandrakes.
Yeah.
You know, so it's sort of like, yeah, it's like, you know, every year we got to be doing this. Petrification's going to be happening. We, you know, we raise the mandrakes. We got all of our solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like sometimes it's going to happen. It's wizard school. You know, like I don't know if that could possibly be like in the back of the minds of people. It's like it's inconvenient that it happened.
Right. And like it is bad that we don't know how it happened, and it's happened like a bunch, but like we'll fix it.
Right. Yeah. There's a solve, not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like as long as it doesn't keep happening, then we're all good.
Right.
Yeah, but honestly, credit to I'll get there in a minute. So we'll continue. Yeah.
All right. The next like page is basically just a whole bunch of Prisoner of Azkaban set up. As the second years, I'll have to choose their new subjects, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. Ron surprises me and says, like, we keep all our old subjects, or else I'd have ditched Defense Against the Dark Arts, which I guess he's assuming it'll just be Lockhart again the next year. The pattern hasn't really revealed itself to Ron yet.
Right, yes. Yeah. Which, you know, based on the fact that, like he said, brother's going there for years and nobody's ever had the same DADA professor for 2 years straight, it seems like it should be pretty evident.
It should be, yeah.
But it is crazy to me. I highlighted that exact same line because I was like, it's so crazy for me to think that any of the Golden Trio would be like, yeah, you know, Defense Against the Dark Arts, who needs it? It's
right.
Like, that ends up being like all of their speciality.
Yeah, you right. know, that's, like, that's the big that's, one.
That is the big one. That's like the most important class.
Yeah.
That they end up taking. So, and Hermione gets that. She says, no, but that's very important. And then it's kind of interesting just to sort of see like the different ways in like which everybody is attempting to figure out like what to take. We get kind of mention of, I think, arithmancy and ancient runes.
Yep. We get mention of divination by Percy, surprisingly.
Yes.
When he says, it depends where you want to go. It's never too early to start thinking about the future. So I'd recommend divination, which is just like, Percy is pro divination. I mean, he gets an OWL in it, so I guess he must either be successful or at least understand how to take the tests or whatever.
Yeah, no, I know. That's like, I mean, that's a thing, is that like Trelawney is not a very good teacher, I don't think. I mean, I think that's safe to say.
Yeah.
Like the OWLs seem more like a standardized test that maybe aren't devised by the professors themselves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not, I mean, I'm sure anybody, you know, could relate to a scenario where you had a not so good teacher for a course, but you like, even if you didn't learn from them, maybe you still like self-taught yourself.
Yeah, like from the book.
From the book or whatever. Yeah. So it's like, you know, my chemistry teacher wasn't very good, but I still was able to eventually understand, you know, the basic fundamentals of high school chemistry.
Yeah. I mean, like, even like Lavender and Parvati, like, get to the point where they're like, you know, oh, the stars are like this, that means that. And Ferenz is like, that's complete bananas. But but it's the sort of thing that they seem confident in saying because, like, they've read it in the textbooks. Or so, you know, I'm not sure if you're, you know, OWL is like, read these tea leaves. And, you know, Percy looks at it and it's like, yeah, that looks like a hat. That means this. I memorized it out of a book.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly. Right. Yeah.
It's like, that's probably good enough for the test.
Right. Right.
Or the way he phrases the sentence is that it's like he's taking divination as a way to literally glimpse into his own future.
Well, I mean, yeah, if there's anybody who I think has kind of got like the vanity, maybe, you know, like attached to their trajectories, I could see Percy holding on to some of that and hoping to catch a glimpse of his future glory or position as Minister for Magic or something.
Yeah, but I think the other way, the main thing, this, like, the way in which they're all choosing different classes and stuff is just supposed to introduce you to all of what the new classes will be, because they mention ancient runes and arithmancy and divination and care of magical creatures and maybe even Muggle studies.
Right.
So
right,
I think that's all of them. So it's a very concise way to be like, yes, here's what we can look forward to in book three.
I know. Yeah. So that's kind of fun. It's always nice to see the setup, the groundwork.
Yeah.
It also, I was going to say, as we entered this week's chapter, so our last two chapters have been such heavy hitters, and I was like, I could see this one being like a little bit more tame because, yeah, literally, like, you've got the title being Cornelius Fudge, who barely shows up in the chapter at all. The image is the list, which is just not even that important of an artifact to the overall story. And we use an entire page just talking about what classes they're going to take next year.
Right.
With no really significant Chamber of Secrets plot points being discussed at all.
Yeah, not really. Until, I suppose, we get to our next page here. The next thing that happens is, Harry returns to the Gryffindor common room and discovers that someone has just gone through all of his stuff and clearly been looking for something. And of course, we know that this is Ginny looking for Riddle's diary, which she finds.
Yes.
But what is crazy to me about this is that we also are told that the Gryffindors have been given, the second years have been given something new to think about over the Easter holidays. Which is when they're looking at all the class schedules for next year and whatever.
Right.
And when Ginny initially realized that Harry had the diary was way back on Valentine's Day. So it has taken her a good, like, 6 weeks to suddenly decide, like, I got to do something about this.
Like, time to act.
Time to act. And it's like, what? Like, why doesn't this happen, like, on February 15th?
Right.
You know, this
right.
should happen. They're like, because Ginny, what? The reason she does this is because she's afraid Harry is going to figure out how the diary works and figure out she's the one doing it.
Right.
Or that she's been the one responsible. And it's like, what? Like, if that's your fear, that is like happening tomorrow, not a minimum of 6 weeks later.
Yes, yes. You know? This is one of those things where I think, like, time is always very wimbly-wombly when it comes to all of these books. Like, it's unbelievable how any page you read, any interaction that Harry has in class, something eventful is always happening, but it means prior to, you know, like really the distance between Valentine's Day and where we're at right now, so little must be going. Like Harry must just be actually having like regular classes, days of school. Like they're not making any progress. They're not like really discussing any more about the Chamber of Secrets. There's no other attacks. Like it's just been like kind of like a tame stretch of time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's been, but a big stretch of time for Ginny to suddenly just be like, "Welp, that's it. Enough's enough. I'm getting up there.
I'm doing it. Maybe she had to devise a way to do it, because we do know that when the boys try to go up to the girls' dormitories, it, like the stairs like flatten out into a slide and like a caterwauling charm
goes off. Yeah.
So it's like maybe it's like, okay, you got to find like a strategic way to get up there, like string a rope up to the top or something.
No, but it's not. The girls can go to the boys' dormitory. Oh, it's just the other way around, because Hermione comes up to the boys.
You're right. Yeah. So that's I was trying to lend some credence to a scenario that it takes longer than you'd expect in order to get up there, but can't even do that.
Can't even do that. Ginny just suddenly, I guess she just finally freaks out enough to go do it, because she breaks into the boys' dormitory room and steals the diary.
Yes. So this is another one of those, like, kind of in the vein of like the whodunit. So like throughout the story, you know, you're kind of being given glimpses. You as a reader can be hypothesizing. You can be focusing in on the various like red herrings and trying to determine whether or not there's like enough meat on those bones to like point an accusation at somebody. To me, what's really big about the end of this scene right here is the sentence that says, "But only a Gryffindor could have stolen. Nobody else knows our password."
Yeah. Yeah. To which I wrote, "Well, you guys personally broke into the Slytherin common room earlier this year."
There's that. Yes. But like, you know, like Harry's reaction saying, "Exactly," said Harry, to me is sort of like, okay, now if you're the reader, it's like, it's a Gryffindor.
Right.
Like it almost has to be
a
Gryffindor, which even that, you know, it's like, you're like, no, Gryffindors are the good guys.
Right. How could it be?
They can't be the ones that, like, you know, attacking the school. That seems so unlikely. That means it's someone in our camp. So it's like, at that point in time, it's like, okay, could it be Percy?
Right.
You know, it's
this is when you're really supposed to narrow in. Like, it's it almost has to be. Who else could it be?
It almost has to be. But then the next thing that happens in the chapter is we hard cut to Quidditch.
Yeah.
You know, they wake up to a brilliant sunshine, a light refreshing breeze.
They're like it has to be a Gryffindor anyway, Quidditch.
It's like, what happened next?
Yeah,
who did they think did it?
Yeah, like, did you guys like circle around the common room, get some alibis or anything? Or
exactly because it seems like anybody in Gryffindor common room would be like, wait, somebody ransacked your room? Like, that's important for all of us to know, because we all live here.
Right, exactly.
You know, like everybody's going to want to know what's up. But we hard cut over to Quidditch, which I also think is kind of interesting, because, you know, it's, you know, like, whatever, Oliver's super excited. They're eating their breakfast. They're going out to the Quidditch pitch. In the process of going out to the Quidditch pitch, I believe, let's see, Harry hears the "kill this time, let me rip, tear." Yes. You know, whatever. And that...
Such false promises, Basilisk.
I know, seriously.
Someone to shreds, why don't you? I dare you. Right. I dare you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't believe it.
You're all eyes. We know
all talk.
We know it.
Hiss and no bite.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So anyway, Harry hears it. He lets Ron and Hermione know. Hermione immediately has a brain blast and says, "Harry, I think I've just understood something. I've got to go to the library."
Yes.
And then she runs away. And in doing so, basically now they go on down to the Quidditch pitch, where everybody's getting all lined up. And out of nowhere, Professor McGonagall comes charging onto the field carrying an enormous purple megaphone, which is like one of those scenes where I'm like, if they did this in the movies, I probably would have critiqued it. And then somebody would have been like, no, that's canon, actually.
Yeah.
Giant purple right microphone. There. Yes. Yes, indeed. Megaphone rather, not microphone. But anyway, so, This situation, I think, is kind of interesting, because it's like, okay, we've kind of narrowed in on the possibility that it almost certainly needs to be a Gryffindor, but then everybody's at the Quidditch pitch for the game. You know, like the whole school's out there. So it's like, at that point in time, you're like, does it have to be like a member of staff?
Right.
Like, who's... like, who's in the school?
It's McGonagall. She came from the school.
She came from
the school. It's a Gryffindor. She would know the password.
There we go. She probably sets the password, in fact.
Probably.
Yeah. Did you suspect McGonagall?
Not even one bit.
Yeah, no, me neither. Yeah. And in fact, this is actually one of my favorite. Like, there's something I really, really, really love. I mean, I love McGonagall as a character in general. But there are these moments, because she's so, like, firm and strict about everything, when she does get kind of, like, soft and caring, it's like you feel like she really means it.
I know. It's maybe the sternness is just like, this is my professional, I'm a teacher mode, but like there are like, I do care about all of you a lot. I just don't like act like it, you know.
Well, you know, it's sort of like, in order to maintain order, you know, I need to keep this stony facade. I need to be your teacher. I'm not your friend, like whatever. But then it's like, you know, when push comes to shove, it's like, no, I do care about you guys a lot. And I do feel for you. And I see the struggles you go through and everything. It's just, it's not my job. It's not my position to be there being that person for you. But then she's being really good with Harry and Ron and everything.
Yeah. Although, let's back up a sec. Because before the Quidditch match gets canceled, this stood out to be so unusual. Another just random Madam Hooch moment, which I still don't know what she even does. But the teams walked onto the field to tumultuous applause. Oliver Wood took off for a warm-up flight around the goalposts. Madam Hooch released the balls. And then that's the part that is baffling to me, because the next sentence is, the Hufflepuffs, who played in Canary Yellow, were standing in a huddle having a last-minute discussion of tactics. So I'm like, wait. She released the balls before the game started? What are you doing?
Oh, the blunders, just like Oliver's up there doing like a warm-up lap or whatever. And he's just getting battered.
Just getting battered by blunders.
By both blunders, which are like, we have no other targets, so this guy's up here. So, you know.
I know.
What's knocking him
off? I guess the snitch is just loose already.
I guess so.
I mean, a part of me feels like that sort of makes sense. Like, the Seekers can't watch it come out of the box and immediately start following it. Like, as of the game starting, it's already out there. But, like, if you know that's the case, then the Seekers, like, if I was Wood, I'd be like, Harry, you need to be on the pitch like 30 minutes earlier. Just, like, be looking for it whole time.
Just be looking.
While no one's there. Okay, you got it?
Yeah, cool. You stand on the ground, look at the sun.
Do not lose that snitch.
Yeah. Keep an eye on it at all costs.
Anyway, okay, that's all I wanted to say. I don't understand. That seems like a poor order of operations. Hooch.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Yes. But let's get onto McGonagall.
Yeah. So we got McGonagall, who basically says, like, Potter, I think you better come with me. And then Ron basically is like, running over and is like, wait, what about me? And McGonagall's like, yes, perhaps you should come too, Weasley. And they get up to the hospital wing, where she says, this is going to be a bit of a shock, in a surprisingly gentle voice. And it's like, oh man, she's scared. Oh, the worst. And yeah, we discover that there has been a double attack, which maybe the double attack is what's really like stressing people out so much. Or maybe everybody just cares deeply about Hermione and they're like, no, she's our best student. If she's down.
Well, the last double attack was on a ghost, you know?
True.
Which is that's the part that seemed like it really freaked everyone out. Like, hey, what can hurt a ghost?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. So then we're discovering that Hermione has been attacked, and Madame Pomfrey is bending over. And this is one of those things where there's a correction from the audiobook over to the written copy. The original copy of this story described the other person who has been attacked, who we of course know to be Penelope Clearwater, as a fifth year girl, not a sixth year girl. And I believe, what's up?
Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to figure out where does it say sixth-year girl?
Oh, it says Madame Pomfrey was bending over a sixth-year girl with long curly hair.
Okay.
Harry recognized her as the Ravenclaw that accidentally asked for directions to the Slytherin common room.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And on the bed next to her was Hermione.
It used to say fifth. Now it's sixth. Okay. So. Yeah.
So, and I think it's because, does she end up being a head girl? I can't remember. Next year. But I think the idea here is that her and Percy are just in the same year.
Got it.
Because next year is Percy's last year.
Right.
So I think that, otherwise she would just be like a year below Percy. So anyway, just modification, but I always find those to be incredibly interesting when I find them. This is the point where now that we know the whole story, because we've read the story so many times, Hermione is holding a small circular mirror, and this is because she has, of course, realized that it's a basilisk, and upon realizing it's a basilisk, she's peeking around corners.
Which immediately pays off.
Thank goodness. And I think she has also handed one to... to Penelope as well. Does it say that they both had one or just Hermione?
I think they just both used Hermione's.
Okay. Maybe that's what it is. Yeah. Okay.
But do you think the basilisk like cannot shred up the petrified people? Like once they're petrified, they're just like, oh no, it's basically a rock now. You know, who else is even around this time?
I know. Yeah. It's like, it's not like there's anybody there to like chase them off or something.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah. It's like what otherwise the basilisk is like, man, you want to know what's extremely inconvenient? I've got these eyes that can like petrify stuff
and laser burn them.
Yeah. We don't get to see any scorch marks on this particular scene.
That's true. We don't get to look at the scene on this time.
Yeah. But no, it is like one of those things where it's just like, man, well, oh, What are you doing there, Basilisk? What's your play? Or is it just meant to be like terrifying? Like, I guess we know eventually they're trying to lure Harry down, so maybe he's just leaving like some breadcrumbs.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like he's trying to kill all of these people and failing over and over and over again.
It's not working so well.
Not working so well, Basilisk.
Yeah.
Come on, man. Shred somebody.
You say you're gonna.
You say you're gonna.
You're being awfully creepy to 10-year-old us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. Y'all, I've got to say, I love international travel. I don't know if there's anything that opens your eyes and mind more to different walks of life than immersing yourself inside of new ones. But one hesitation I always have about going somewhere new is how to best navigate the differing languages. But that's where Rosetta Stone can help. Because for me, it's not just about like the fear of getting lost, although to be fair, it's not a concern either. But to me, the immersion goes so much further than simply being somewhere else. I want to engage with and respect the locale by communicating in their tongue, not my own. And that's what's so great about Rosetta Stone. They provide 25 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, and more. And they use such an intuitive approach designed for you to pick up the language naturally, so you're really learning to speak, listen, and the one I always find the most fascinating, think in a new language. And what's even better is that when you sign up, it's for life. Yeah, a lifetime membership, because let's face it, we can only travel to so many new places, but so fast. But with all the time in the world, you can be ready for any adventures ahead. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Through the Gryffindor listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off your unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Anyway, all the students are forced back to their common rooms here. There's another great little misdirection on Percy, where Percy Weasley was sitting in a chair behind Lee, but for once he didn't seem keen to make his views heard, which one is like sort of red herring. That's sort of like throwing shade at him. But then George sort of covers for him and says, that Ravenclaw girl, Penelope Clearwater, she's a prefect. I don't think he thought the monster would dare attack a prefect, which is like, Percy literally said that earlier in the story.
He did.
So there's that. And it's like but it's also sort of like a rare, like sweet moment from Percy where the real reason he's not talking is because he's so worried about his girlfriend.
I know, but like, this is like one of those crazy things where I'm like, why not just tell people?
I know, like you're right. It is another thing. It's just like, dude, Percy, it's like, I love that you love your girlfriend and stuff like that, but stop being so embarrassed relationship.
I can see a world where you're home over the summer, you're all living in the borough. It's like, you know, the parameters and status and positions and years and everything that you have at school is not here to protect you. Your siblings are Fred and George.
Right.
They're inevitably going to give you a hard time for having a girlfriend because the high schoolers be
right.
like that.
Yeah.
You know, I could see a world where it's like, okay, maybe you don't want to talk about it, or like put yourself in the position to have that conversation. And this is me attempting to go back into the mind of like a 16-year-old version of myself.
Right.
That could be more secretive with this information. But you've been at school for almost a full year now. It's like, have you guys been spending the whole year sneaking around
in the dungeons?
Because next year we know that they're just going to be openly in a relationship.
I know,
like it's a thing, like everybody just knows what's going on. Nobody's like busting them for it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's totally fine. It's going to be fine. The other thing, though, just slightly before that, though, is Lee Jordan is recounting all the various victims, and he says there's two Gryffindors, not counting a Gryffindor ghost, one Ravenclaw, one Hufflepuff. And this is sort of like, it's like earlier in the chapter, we've just decided, like, well, it almost has to be a Gryffindor. But then all of a sudden, it's like, well, now it's looking like the Gryffindors are dropping like flies, and Slytherin's the only one who hasn't had any victims yet.
Right.
And so it's like, wait, so is it a Slytherin? You know, so again,
the confusion.
Right. Yeah. This again kind of goes back to like the whodunit model, where it's just sort of like, it's like, wait, no, them? I was a page ago, I was sure it had to be a Gryffindor, but now are we thinking it's not?
Right.
Could it be Hermione?
Yeah. She attacked herself.
She attacked herself.
Brilliant, I say.
Yes, yes, indeed.
There it is. And let's see. Then they get down to the bottom of the page and they say, "What are we going to do?" said Ron quietly. And Harry's here. "Do you think they suspect Hagrid?" And it's like, how could they not at this point? They should absolutely suspect Hagrid at this point. Like, if this is why he was expelled, why they broke his wand, they should 1,000,000% be asking him questions already.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
like, I mean, they're wrong. They'd be wrong about it, but they absolutely should suspect him.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is like what it comes down to. It's sort of like, if that's the last known evidence any of us have to do anything with the Chamber of Secrets and the person is still in proximity, someone needs to be talking to
him. Someone needs to be talking to him, man. I mean,
that's just covering your bases. That's you know, simple safety.
But yeah, he goes, I can't believe it's him this time. Last time, sure.
You know? He was just a kid then.
Yeah.
But so then they finally decide for the first time all year to bust out Harry's dad's old cloak.
Oh, it is about time, boys. It is about time.
I know. Yeah. If you have an invisibility cloak and you're at wizard school and you're not using it like at least once a week, I think you're doing it wrong.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
It's like someone who has like a really nice car and they just leave it parked in their garage all the time. It's like, you got to drive it.
You got to drive it, dude. Yeah, like, what are you doing?
What's the point of having it?
You have one of the Deathly Hallows, bro. Not that you're aware of that or anything, or even what those are.
Yeah.
It sounds like the trip underneath the invisibility cloak is not so easy because there's so many ghosts and teachers and such roaming the corridors. And yet, this sentence surprises me. It says, it was with relief that they reached the oak front doors and eased them open. I'm like, you have all these guards roaming all over your school and nobody's manning the front door? Like, come on, Dumbledore. Like, what are you doing?
I know. That's
no one's on the front door.
Right. It's like Dumbledore is supposedly the most brilliant wizard ever. You know, like just raw intelligence and magical prowess. And it's sort of like, it's like he can figure out the Horcruxes. He can figure out and piece together all these obscure memories and details from things that happened, you know, I think at that point in time, like 70 years prior.
Yeah.
And here we are, and it's like, really? It's like, there's not a huge list of creatures capable of petrifying things that could have something to do with Salazar Slytherin. And
right.
If you've talked to Newt ever, you know what a basilisk is.
Right.
Hagrid's having the rooster problem. Like, yeah, these are the puzzle pieces, my friend.
These are the puzzle pieces right there.
Yeah.
My only allowance for this is that this is a Dumbledore's big plan situation. And he's like, Harry's, he's going to go to, I mean, I don't know how he doesn't know about the diary. So no. He'd have no way to know that Harry knew about Hagrid.
Right.
But maybe he's like, Harry's probably going to go visit Hagrid tonight. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he seems to know that he's there later.
He does seem to know that he's there later, which that was something. So yeah, we can zoom forward, I think, a little bit here, because basically Harry and Ron are underneath the cloak. They make their way down to Hagrid, who's clearly like realized that at this point in the equation, too much time has passed.
Yeah.
And he feels fairly certain that somebody's coming for him. And he's correct.
And he's prepared to shoot them with a crossbow.
With a crossbow.
I know. He says he's leveling the crossbow at them as they open the door. I'm like, who would he have fired it at had it been them?
Yeah, Lucius shows up first. Lucius dies.
Absolutely. You know what? Yes. If Lucius shows up first, he has got a crossbow bolt in the chest.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So that's a good point, though, where it's sort of like, it's like, Hagrid, I appreciate the fact that you're like on edge, but like, that's a full-blown weapon.
Yeah. If you think shooting someone with the crossbow is going to get you off the hook.
It is. It's not going to help. It's not going to help.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then basically very, very shortly after they arrive, They are served cups of boiling water because Hagrid forgot to add the tea bags. There's fruitcake on a plate, which this is always one of those things where I sort of love the fact that Hagrid always does have baked goods.
He's baking food down there, man.
It's just like if he's not tinkering or meddling with creatures, he's meddling with his favorite new recipes.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to imagine.
Yes.
But yeah, then Dumbledore walks in. He's looking deadly serious. This kind of similar to the McGonagall thing. This feels like kind of like a juxtaposition. It's like normally, McGonagall's very stern and she was very soft in this chapter, and normally Dumbledore is very like whimsical and upbeat and fun and positive, and he's looking very intense.
Yeah.
Which we know he can look. This happens more times going throughout the future. So I think it's good usage when it's there, because it gets the point across very, very effectively. Let's see here. And then with Dumbledore, though, also comes in Cornelius Fudge, I'm not really going to defend Fudge or anything, but at least to his credit, he doesn't really seem happy about the fact that he's there.
He does not. Yeah. He's, like we said earlier, he's like mostly just like, we've got to be seen to be doing something. And it's like, yeah, but like you are doing something and what feels like the obvious thing to do. So like, I don't know, just own it, I guess.
Right. Right.
But,
yeah.
But then he's like so wishy-washy about it. He says, not a punishment, Hagrid, more a precaution. If someone else is caught, you'll be let out with a full apology. And it's like, to me, it's also crazy that if it's not a punishment and it is just a precaution, that like maybe you don't need to go all the way to Azkaban.
I know, just take Hagrid from the school. Go put him in like a holding container at the ministry.
Right.
Surely that exists.
Surely that exists. Surely you have any other holding facility between like people who have committed crimes and people who are sentenced for life. Like, all crimes end in Azkaban in the wizarding world.
Right, right. Yeah. Yes, yes. But so Azkaban also feels like, yet again, inside of this chapter, another small setup for the next book installment.
Absolutely.
As long as we're keeping track of those things. Then Hagrid gets yet another visitor. It's a very happening hut on this particular evening, where Lucius finally shows up. And this is like one of those scenes again, like where it's like, I think a lot of times we have turned Lucius into such a joke of a character, and on like the broad strokes version of him, he's pretty ineffective at almost everything.
Yeah.
And we've made fun of Lucius kind of relentlessly, to be honest with you. So he's sort of similar to like Lockhart, where it's like, it's really funny to think about Lockhart as a character, but when you hear him talk, you're like, you are so frustrating.
Right.
Like, it is driving me nuts to imagine somebody behaving in the way that you behave. But then you've got Lucius who shows up, and man, he is just a jerk.
He absolutely is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's making fun of Hagrid's house. He's being very like, I don't know, smug.
Very smug. I mean, because he's basically there and he's just like, well, I've got a brand new toy here and I'm going to go play with it and I get to take Dumbledore away from the school and you can't stop me, Cornelius. This is something only the governors can do. Yeah, basically.
Excellent evil laugh.
Yes, thank you.
So basically he says, I think that he's also, let's see here. He says, I simply called at the school and was told that the headmaster was here. And what exactly did you want with me, Lucius? Said Dumbledore. He spoke politely, but the fire was still blazing in his blue eyes. So I kind of want to like dial in on that, because it's the second time inside of this chapter that Dumbledore's eyes sort of have this like fiery nature to them, mm-hmm. which is not even the last time that we'll see this happen in the series altogether. Like, Dumbledore is associated with fire on numerous occasions, which this is kind of like one of our like fun fan theories, is that like Dumbledore as an animagus could be a phoenix.
Yeah.
Cause he's obviously like very highly like aligned with them. And then like even like the huge displays of magic that we see from him, like in the cave, for instance, like when, you know, he's fending off like the Inferi, he's creating
big
like
fire,
a massive inferno. Mm-hmm. I think he's also like very strong. I think after Harry arrives back in Goblet of Fire, Dumbledore like lifts him with like a surprising amount of like strength.
Yeah, which like
Phoenixes also have. What was the other one?
No healing tears that I'm aware of.
No healing tears.
Oh, he likes music.
He does like music. Yeah. He says like the music, magic beyond anything we do within these walls.
Yeah. And yeah. Then, like the Phoenix song. Lament or whatever, like lift your spirits.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So he does. And then of course, you know, yeah, he has a Phoenix himself.
He has a Phoenix. And there's that like line in Fantastic Beasts where it's like a Phoenix will appear to a Dumbledore in need or whatever.
Right. So we know that they're highly aligned. And I think also in Fantastic Beasts, he says a line like, I've always had an affinity for the
legendary birds or whatever.
Yeah.
That's it sounds like Pokemon.
The Pokemonification of it. But you get
one of which is a Moltres.
Which
is a Phoenix and is a Ho-Oh, I guess. And
right.
Both there.
But the other thing that I think is interesting about this that I wanted to draw attention to his eyes on is, and this was literally just as I was reading this chapter, because basically this is a situation where Hagrid knows that Ron and Harry are inside of the cabin, but it also definitely seems like Dumbledore knows that they're inside.
It definitely seems like it.
And we get two references to his eyes, which is sort of like what drew my attention there in the first place. But it brought me back to Mad-Eye Moody and his ability to see through Harry's cloak when he's like trapped inside of the trick stair in Goblet of Fire in the middle of the night with the egg. And I was like, okay, it's kind of fascinating because Mad-Eye's eye, the one that can like do all these powers, is described as being like electric blue.
Yeah.
And Dumbledore is described as having like piercing blue eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is there a world where Dumbledore's both of his eyes are like the equivalent of like Mad Eyes?
Yeah. Where he's just like, it's like when he says it's like piercing blue eyes, he's like, he can literally look through you if he wants to.
Yes. I mean, and like there are so many occasions where Dumbledore's vision is described as like as if he, like Harry's being X-rayed.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I'm kind of like, that's sort of wild.
Right.
You know, like, is it possible that Dumbledore made Mad-Eye Moody's eye?
Oh, yeah. I mean, doesn't seem impossible because we see them in Dumbledore's memories in the Pensieve where he's already friends with Moody before he has the eye.
Pre-electric eye.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay. Electric blue. I don't think the eye itself is like motorized.
I don't think there's no muggle technology in there. Yeah.
No. But anyway, I was like, okay, that's kind of interesting. I've never really considered that before. I've always assumed, you know, that Dumbledore, like, you know, he's got like a super sensory, even just being like a Legilimens, it almost sometimes feels like that could be like a way to be like, I'm going to read the memory or I'm going to read the minds of the people in the room. And it's like, in doing so, it's like, if you hear Harry's thoughts, it's like, I know Harry's in the room. Like, to me, that's always been like a way that he could have like discovered.
Yeah, that they're there.
That they're there. Yeah.
But there's like that. There is like it does like a like he sees them or something, because it says for a second, Harry was almost sure Dumbledore's eyes flickered toward the corner where he and Ron stood hidden.
Yes.
Yeah.
So so it does. I mean, it seems like if nothing else, he knows where they are.
He knows that they are there and where they are. And like clearly the message, you will find that I will only truly have left the school when none here are loyal to me. You will also find that help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask for it, is clearly directed at Harry.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So both Hagrid and Dumbledore just openly having discussions with the unknown people in the room.
And much to like his mouth was just like, admirable sentiments. Okay. Thank you for randomly announcing that.
Yes.
We shall all miss your highly individual way of running things. Bye-bye.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But of course, Dumbledore's line there, like the having, you will find that I've only truly left the school when none here are loyal to me. This is definitely like one of those, like it's a definite setup for the Chamber of Secrets coming soon, where Harry is in the chamber beneath the school. And I think Tom Riddle like says Dumbledore has been forced from the school by the mere memory of me.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then like Harry comes back and he's like, Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Like he's here.
As long as people are loyal to him,
which I am.
Fox.
Chills.
Oh man.
Boom. Amazing.
So amazing.
Cool. So cool. Or is it Fox or is it just Dumbledore himself?
It's Fox.
But yeah, so anyway, that pretty much, yeah. Then of course we round off with Hagrid speaking also to the room, and we get the mention of someone will need to feed Fang for me, and also that you would follow the spiders if anybody needed to find out some stuff.
Yeah. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
Fudge stared at him with amazement. I highlighted and I wrote reasonable.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's like one of those situations where it's like, if you don't know what else is going on, you're like, What?
What? What are you talking about spiders for, dude?
It's like, especially because in this exact situation, the reason that the Minister for Magic is there in the first place is because Hagrid had been known to be keeping a very dangerous spider inside of the castle.
Right.
And there is Hagrid saying to seemingly no one,
right,
follow the spiders.
Right.
It's almost like if you're the minister in this moment, if you're Fudge, you're like, yeah, we got the right guy.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like,
yeah, it's definitely him.
Right. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like, follow the spiders. That's what you're going with in this plea for innocence.
Yeah. Because you're apparently talking to me.
right.
If I didn't want to know anything, Fudge.
Yeah. If it was me, I'd follow the spiders. We know that's what you would do.
Yeah. Sounds like maybe you are following some spider orders, you know?
Yeah. Maybe so.
Yeah. Also, there's a line down here. I think it's from, I don't actually know who's saying, Ron, I think it says, there will be an attack a day with him gone, talking about Dumbledore not being there, which I'm just like, what do you think Dumbledore is doing to prevent the other attacks?
True,
you
know? true. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, secretly in the night, Dumbledore's having mad duels
with the basilisk.
He's winning most of the time.
Most of the time. He is thwarting that guy off. Woo!
Yeah, he's doing it.
Got him.
So anyway, there's chapter 14. I feel like it's a little bit of like a setup chapter. I think it's, you know, kind of giving us some exposition, some like overall big plot points and that type of thing. But I don't know if I want to call it like a fluff chapter, but it's sort of interesting. It hops around a little bit. Not everything is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the very secret diary.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but
exactly.
Then the next one is Aragog, so things are going to ramp right back up.
Yeah. We're about to. We've had like the very small, like, you know, the plot has been building and building and building. We had a small like little plateau there, and we're about to like rock it right off.
We're in the middle of the rising action.
The finale. Yeah, as it were. So, anyway, yeah, that closes out chapter 14.
There we go. Well, I've got a review for us here.
Lay it on me.
From Blind Guy 93.
Okay.
Says, hey brothers, been following you both for years, absolutely love the podcast. I have a question. It seems extraordinarily unlikely that Snape would ever haphazardly leave his potion book around. I don't think he wanted Harry to find it, but do you think there was some part of him that wanted another talented, underprivileged Slytherin to find it? Also, I truly believe Snape was great at occlumency because of the deep, albeit troubling, love he had for Lily. Voldemort would never be able to pass through that type of love.
Ooh.
Which I liked this idea that the real reason Snape is good at occlumency is because he has one secret that he absolutely doesn't want anyone to know, like basically his whole life.
Yeah.
And that is that he's in love with Lily Evans.
Yes.
And he even when he makes the deal with Dumbledore, he says, no one must ever know.
Right.
And it's like, that's his condition. And he's like, the one good thing about you, okay. it's like Snape has been keeping this secret for so long. And he's like, I will never, ever let anyone find this out about me.
Right.
Like, I'm going to have to be good at occlumency, so it can't even be read out of my brain.
I know. So it's interesting, like, that would be his compulsion, would be like, I don't want anybody to read my mind and discover this piece of information. Because as you were saying it, I think that maybe that is how this reviewer meant the question. But as I was hearing it, I was like, oh, is it almost as if like Snape is protected because like the primary fundamental reason for his like secrecy towards anything is love, which is like a vault that Voldemort could never.
That could, like, maybe he's not good at occlumency. He just like, because he's so motivated by love, he is protected.
Yes, his motivations are all love. And so it's like, it's almost like an encrypted code that Voldemort can't even like, he can't even see, let alone break into, because he's so incapable of it. So it's like, he is unable, I mean, we know this to be true, like, he is so unable to believe that Snape would be acting so on behalf of love that he would betray Voldemort at all, which is his fatal flaw, basically.
I do like that. I like this idea. Either way, I like both versions of it, where either the reason he's mastered occlumency is to hide the fact that he's in love with Lily, or the idea that because he's so in love with her that it is, and that's his like core motivation for everything, that he is protected from like probing and stuff.
But even this would fit well, though, like on the love notion, with it would fit well because I think Dumbledore could read Snape's mind. He could know. He could, like, because Dumbledore understands love.
Right.
So he could potentially read Snape's mind more effectively than Voldemort ever could. But that is like the edge that Dumbledore has over Voldemort in the end.
Right.
Like, Voldemort can't crack through, so he can never know the underlying motivations, whereas Dumbledore can crack through, and therefore he can have ironclad trust in Snape. And it's like, it's not just faith.
But Dumbledore doesn't have to read it. Snape just tells him.
No, I know. I know. Yeah. But like at some point in time, it's like one of those questions where it's like, both Voldemort and Dumbledore are absolutely certain that they can trust Snape.
Yeah.
And it's like one of them is going to have to be wrong.
Yes.
And they're both certain that it's not them.
Right.
You know, but it's like, is it the case that like Dumbledore has like it's ignorance on the part of Voldemort that makes him unable to figure it out, where it's knowledge on the part of Dumbledore that allows that faith to remain.
Right.
Which I prefer.
Yeah.
You know, because then it's sort of like, ha, Voldemort. Foiling your own plans yet again.
As usual. It's surprising because Voldemort, like, must know that he can't probe Snape's mind, you know?
Well, unless that's what I mean. Like, unless it's so encrypted inside of Snape's mind that it's like he is seeing inside of Snape's mind. He can see the things that aren't protected by love.
I see.
So he can see everything else.
Right.
But that would mean... that would mean that he thinks he's in a room and he's seeing, like, kind of like Hagrid's hut. It's like he thinks he's seeing the room for what it is, but he doesn't know what's being hidden from him.
Right. He can't see Harry and Ron.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 As for the copy of Advanced Potion Making, I too have found it to be unusual that this is something that Snape would part with.
Yes. Yeah. It seems weird that he would forget it down there.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, I would have to go back and revisit our notes from Dumbledore's Big Plan, but it would shock me if we didn't think it was somehow relevant.
I know. But even then, it's like, it's really just a coin flip about whether or not Harry or Ron gets the book.
I know. But I feel like if Ron gets the book, he's just annoyed. Like, I think takes like Harry. I think that's like Harry's cunning bleeding through just ever so slightly.
Yeah.
You know, that he's like willing to be like, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah. Absolutely. But like, if he didn't get, if Ron had gotten the book, he would, like, Harry wouldn't have been reading it.
No, he wouldn't have. Yeah. No, of course. Yeah. So I don't think Ron would have been at like a distinct advantage if he had it. I think it's only at an advantage in Harry's hands.
Yes.
So maybe that's the coin flip. It's just like worth taking the chance on.
Right.
You know, but I'm trying to think, is there anything really, really, really major that he learns from the Half-Blood? I mean, he learns a lot from the Half-Blood Prince.
Well, the major thing that happens is that he wins the Felix Felicis.
That's
how he gets the secret from Slughorn.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all of those things feel like they could be relevant in that capacity then, because
it's conceivable that the Felix Felicis contest could have been like a known tradition of Slughorns on day one.
It definitely feels like it.
Yeah. That could have been in there. So Dumbledore could have maybe wanted this, and he like, There's a world where Dumbledore, like, knows Harry wasn't going to take potions, but now will be allowed to take potions, and he'll discover that on day one. And
like, that all plays into it in my mind.
Actually, you know what? Because Ron, here's the kicker. Ron wasn't going to take potions. McGonagall almost messes it up for him.
Oh, you're right.
McGonagall's like, Weasley, go with him. He'll look too happy.
You're doing it too.
Yeah.
Like, oh, man.
That throws the wrench.
Because what I was going to say even more than that too, though, is that we always replace the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. And Harry even thinks he's recruiting Slughorn for Defense Against the Dark Arts. But like, the fact that Dumbledore is looking for someone for potions so that Snape can move to Defense Against the Dark Arts would even allow for like such a situation to exist, because I can't imagine Harry would also get away with having Snape's own copy of the book in a classroom of like 8 people.
Yeah.
He couldn't have taken, like, Harry's grades weren't good enough to have allowed him to take the NEWT level anyway. So he had to find a way to get Snape out of potions. Otherwise, Harry couldn't have taken it.
Right.
You know? So a lot of it fits together.
A lot of it does fit together in a way that, like, Dumbledore could be like, leave your potions book there, man.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, because, I mean, then he can win the Felix, which then the Felix is... not only does he win the Felix from Slughorn, he uses the Felix on Slughorn.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
So, yeah, it all.
Well, that's the other reason he wants Slughorn, is because he knows Slughorn has this memory. Like, exactly. Dumbledore's already cooking on this.
Right. Yeah. But maybe he just knows, like, Slughorn's the perfect person to pick. It's like, this is like killing, like, 4 birds with 1 stone.
It is. Yeah. All right. You know what? The realization that Ron wasn't going to be there and the fact that it's a coin flip is only a coin flip by accident really makes it seem more intentional that the book was left there on Dumbledore's instructions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could see that. It all works out so perfectly.
It does all work out so nicely.
It's like it comes together in such a remarkable way.
Yeah.
Because, of course, he's not going to have his book. That's the other thing.
Right. He's not going to have it.
Because he doesn't know.
And Dumbledore knows he won't have it.
Right.
Because he knows Snape. He knows Harry thinks he's not taking it.
Right.
Yeah. But he knows Harry wants to be an Auror, and he knows he's going to be allowed to take it once Slughorn's the professor.
Yeah. No, it fits.
Yeah. It fits too well. Yep. So great question.
Great question. Snape's not being haphazard.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's a plan.
This is a plan. Yeah. Yeah,
there we go. We got there.
Snape and Dumbledore are already cooking so many other things together in this book. So.
I know. Yeah. It's a big Snape book. Yeah. For sure. Okay. Great question. Man, I have to say, please leave your reviews and please add your questions.
Yes. Because please.
I feel like one of my favorite parts of each of these episodes is getting to the end and somebody asking such an insightful question.
Dude, I'm so impressed by the questions people leave in the reviews because, I mean, people ask us questions about Harry Potter all the time. And almost never are we getting anything like new or juicy out of those questions. But almost every review question is like,
I know, it's like, wait.
Great question. So keep them coming. Well done. Thank you for your reviews. We really appreciate it. It does help the podcast. I know we haven't talked about the Chartables any here recently, but last time I checked, we were presently in the top 10 for the U.S., Canada, and Great Britain.
No
for
way.
Entertainment news. You know,
that's amazing.
But
that's
still,
amazing.
There.
And we of course also in an area where we're having less progress, but almost in a fun way, is our goal for 100,000 subscribers.
Oh, we're getting there, man. We're almost to 30,000.
I know. We're inching our way up. It's happening slowly but surely. If you're one of those people that's like, oh, but my one won't contribute to the whole. It's like,
it will.
Yes, indeed. So be, you know, if you're listening, if you're watching on YouTube, definitely slap that subscribe button. If you're listening in your car or, you know, somewhere and you're like, all right, you know what? They got me today. I'm doing it. That's it. I'm signing up.
Do it.
We'd appreciate it. It'd be so much fun to get that. You get a silver play button at 100,000.
You
so.
Do. Yeah.
Anyway, that's our very selfish reason for asking you to do so. So we appreciate it.
We'll put it on the set.
There you go. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah. All right. But otherwise, guys, thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Make sure you turn in next week for Chapter 15, Aragog, here on Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager. And the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants. They all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.